Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you on, have you with us this morning. It is a Wednesday morning. It's the 29th of August, and another sultry, hot, humid day, oppressive in every way. But we welcome you, and however you are looking to find relief from that, hopefully we play some small part in that. maybe we'll make you even more hot under the collar. Who knows? But all of that is fine as we move on. Let me introduce the panel to you this morning. David Soares is here. He is the district attorney for the County of Albany. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I just want to say that Alan sounded so sharp on the trumpet there with that lead-in music,
yeah,
and
was
Jen
good.
On the tambourines. Mm-hmm. You guys are rocking it this
performing live. Wow. It's good stuff. Jen Smith is here fresh from the big debate yesterday.
Yes, indeed.
For district attorney, and that we aired on this station at 1 o'clock. Berkshire County District Attorney. She is a reporter for the Berkshire Eagle, and we're thrilled with that she is affiliated with us as well. Good morning. How are you?
I am thrilled to be here, Joe.
Good to have you. Alan Chartok is with us as well. He moderated that debate. Good morning. How are you?
Well, I was one of them. I was co-equal with Jen, actually. Jen, I had a question for you.
Yes.
Do you want me to save a seat for you at the Berkshire Ramblers concert on Sunday at 7 o'clock, 413-528?
Because I hear those tickets are going fast.
Oh, boy, are they going fast. You know, it's unbelievable. You know, people get mad at me at the end. They always do. They say, well, you know, I need...
At the end of the concert, they get mad at you?
Yeah, that too. and that too. But they also say, you know, that you could get me a ticket if you really wanted to. No. I'm not going to do it.
It's Sunday evening. It's 7 o'clock at the Guthrie Center, and that's in Lenox, correct?
No. That's in Great Barrington.
Great Barrington. My apologies.
Yeah, in the Vancouver.
Bad Berkshire geography there, David.
Yeah. It's Great Barrington. It could be United Barrington.
Was it the jewel of the Berkshires.
That's right. That's what it is.
All right. And it's in Great Barrington, and it's 518.
Yeah.
What's the...
No, it's 413.
Oh, I'm sorry. 413. That's right.
528.
528, 1955.
That's it. A great year.
Okay. There we go.
My mom was born.
And what?
So the year my mom was born.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you looked at her and I looked at her because we thought she said the year I was born and we knew that wasn't true.
Oh, I was doing the immediate math of, oh, thank God Jen's mother is older than me. That was the math I did. Well, good morning, all, and welcome. We have lots of stuff to talk about. Many, many, many stories that are making news, so let's talk about it. Do you think there's going to be, I don't know, it seems like, I feel like a broken record, but do you think there's going to be a time where I'll start the show and say, yeah, there's nothing going on today?
We've managed to live a lifetime in less than 2 years.
Sure.
I don't know if I could take it.
We used to have a guy who did the morning show here on WMC. Only us old people remember it. His name was Robert J. Lertzimer. And every day he would rip and read the AP stories as he came in the room. And one day he lost the AP stories, and he couldn't find them. You could hear him shuffling around looking for all the stuff. And he said, I'm sorry, there is no news today.
There you go.
I wish we could say that.
That's right. I live for that moment.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we had primaries yesterday. Progressive and a Trump acolyte have won in Florida in the gubernatorial primaries. Andrew Gillum, who would be the state's first black governor, was chosen by the Democrats. Republicans nominated President Trump's pick, Ron DeSantis. Meanwhile, in the state of Arizona, Martha McSally, the establishment favorite, won the Republican nomination and will face the Democratic victor, Kristen Sinema, I believe I'm saying that correctly, this fall. What is interesting about all of this is that these are the tea leaves that we are reading to see what could possibly happen in the midterm elections. And we're all looking at this and seeing, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? So I asked the panel, what does this mean?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it means that the Bernie Sanders part of the party, the activists, the people who really get turned on by policy and social policy, have won the day in the Democratic Party. In the Republican Party, obviously, Trump reigns supreme. He lays hands on somebody and they win. It's that simple. And the party of John McCain, who we are all mourning and celebrating in the United States as we speak, that party seems to be no more. So now the Clintonites are out. The moderate Republicans, the Eisenhower Republicans, are out. And the people on the fringes are. Now, all of a sudden, we see, and I don't want to advance the story too much because I know you want to talk about this, Joe, but we see that Trump has been to see the evangelicals and that there is a leak of a tape in which he says, you know, violence, 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 and violence if you elect the Democrats, a piece of red meat to the base. And they believe it. And NPR this morning had a prominent evangelical minister on who was talking about the fact that we're all sinners. And of course, Trump is a sinner, too. But so aren't we all. And that becomes the excuse for evangelical Christians to support a guy who is over the top in terms of his personal fallibility. You can only imagine had anybody ever found out any dirt, which they never did, of course, because he didn't do it, on Barack Obama, what these same people would have been saying and doing. But in any case, you now have these polarized parties. What's interesting in Florida, I think, is that they do not have an open primary system, meaning that you just can't come in and take a ballot if you're unenrolled, as we can in Massachusetts. So that you had to be an enrolled voter, and many of the people who have not traditionally voted were shut out. And yet, the liberal candidate, mayor of Tallahassee, wins. And that only portends a lot of people coming out in the general election who are registered, but who weren't registered in a particular party. Mm. That's all I have to say about that.
So quick fact check, it's cinema. For Christmas cinema. Like the film theater.
Yeah, okay, all right.
So
thank you.
That's that. But I think with the Florida race, what's really going to be interesting is looking at voter turnout. So according to the data that came out, the turnout for the Republican candidate was still larger than the Democrats that turned out. I think overturning, the centrist favorite was still a marginal point. It was only a 3-point lead over Gwen Graham, if I'm not mistaken. And the other Democrat was behind with about 20 points, I think. So it's still going to be really close. And it's going to be about if you're voting in the Democratic Party, can the Democrats get more voters to not only turn out, but turn out for a progressive after, you know, having a centrist who is favored in that race?
I think it's hard to argue that the energy certainly is behind the more progressive candidates in these races. And I think that
or the more reactionary candidates on the other side.
True. But I think Gillum's victory is a reflection of that. I don't know why that's such a surprise, given the temperature of the country right now, given the mood of the country, and the fact that you do have, the furthest, I hate to use the word extreme, factions of both parties that seem to have the most energy behind it and are currently making decisions for the vast majority of us. Now, what I wonder is whether or not the people will come out in November. And I think Florida is just a very difficult state, you know, to call.
Sure. Giuliani thought, because he had been mayor of New York, he was going to go down to Florida, run in the primaries, and that would be turn everything around for him. Wrong.
Yeah. And I think we're always surprised by the Hispanic turnout and the vote, because I think everyone was shocked, given what you know, Trump had said about Mexicans during his campaign. I think everyone was shocked to see how well he did in Dade County and other counties that he should have lost if you were a traditionalist forecasting that election.
Because Hispanics voted for him, is what
you're
saying?
Yeah, because the turnout of Hispanics in his favor was so much more than people could have assumed. I mean, I think we know that the dynamics of the Cuban vote. They tend to vote more conservative in Florida.
Say that again.
Yeah. And so, but one would have speculated, one would have guessed that certainly, given every offensive thing that this particular president had said during that campaign, that they would have done something different.
Well, you know, it gets interesting. It really does. And I should shut my mouth. But here's where what we do know, and that is that racism exists not only among whites towards blacks, but also among shades of black.
Also, absolutely.
Also among, you know, Hispanics and blacks. You know, they're not us, we're better than them, that kind of thing. So it's not that surprising when you parse the whole thing that that's what happens in a case like this.
Well, you know, what's interesting is the fact that with this president and his divisive rhetoric on a daily basis, it's just managed to shed such a huge light on that fact, Alan.
Yes.
And not only as it relates to, for example, Hispanics or people within the African-American community, but it has definitely exposed all of the differences in this country, whether it's ethnic or socioeconomic or cultural.
So when – I'm sorry, Jen, but when – Trump now, all of a sudden we're hearing this tape, this purloined tape that shows Trump basically talking about violence, how there will be violence if the Democrats win. There'll be violence. And he says it three or four times. And the way I received it was, yeah, well, the violence wasn't necessarily going to come from the other guys. The violence might come from, you know, his side of things. One wonders if he didn't let that tape out. Because after all, you're talking to a bunch of evangelicals. You got, 1,000 people, if that, you know, in a conference. This way, he appeals to every racist in the United States, and to this racial separation of those people will be violent towards you and your wife and your white family. That's exactly the kind of thing that this guy does all the time.
Yeah, well, and I mean, to that end, before going back to just this race in Florida, I think it's up to people to really step and say, like, this is just no longer acceptable to hear this kind of language. And he's sort of brushing the default, and it's like, it's not me that's violent, it's the Antifa, who are going to do the violence. But in any other realm, like if this was a teacher talking to a group of students, you know, that teacher would be fired and those students would probably be sent to therapy. Right. Like in any other context, this would be
in Massachusetts or New York, but
extremist language.
Not in Trump land.
Well, here's my frustration with our nation right now is that we continue to normalize this man's behavior. We just accept it and we move on because he's offensive today. He's going to be more offensive at 4 o'clock, you know, this afternoon. And tomorrow morning, he's even going to be more offensive than he was, you know, today. And
sure.
So we just continue to accept it and just move on. The attacks on the media, now all of a sudden we're using the power of the federal government. We're threatening to use the power of the federal government to pursue a private company because his searches on that search engine come up with more negative stories.
Which
he deserves. Yeah. He creates his own negative stories.
Right.
And the idea in the United States of America, where we have a constitution, where we respect the Fourth Estate and we value their role in our society, we have a president that threatens the press, threatens to intervene and use the powers of the federal government, and somehow the Second Amendment folks who are consistently treasuring their Second Amendment to possess weapons don't see the assault on the First Amendment?
Well, mm-hmm. and to go one further on this assault of Google and this assault of Facebook, and I find that fascinating because what about Twitter? I mean, it's the same. It's you're getting the same message as that. I don't know who uses it more than he does.
Yeah.
But not only are we going after the press, but we're going after the social media platforms and the internet platforms that allow stories to go from one place to the other.
We use that platform and we use the power of the presidency of the United States to attack private industry that may disagree with you. So we attack Harley Davidson or we attack Boeing. We attack
right.
All... Right. This is not just about changing a policy or taking a broad stroke look at tech companies or the way things are run. It's not an FCC issue. It's a specific attack on a specific company by the federal government. And that's a huge issue.
And no one blinked an eye when there was the discussion of Time Warner purchasing or that transaction where the subsidiary CNN just happened to be the company that Trump was attacking at the time, and the fact that he used the Department of Justice to intervene in that merger, in that sale, and cause delays there, no one blinked.
Well, you know, I want to take some exception to what you said there, David.
30 seconds.
Okay. You know, you said we're normalizing.
30-second exception.
But we talk about it every single day here. We're not normalizing it. We hate it. You just said it again, which you have said so many times. So why is that normalization?
I agree with David in the sense that it's hard to now outrage us anymore because we're already outraged. You know what I mean? It's like another thing. We'll be right back right after this. We'll talk more. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this, the 29th day of August, 35 minutes past 9 o'clock. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Right before the break, we were talking about this idea of normalization, and we were talking about Alan was taking
exception
to David talking about the normalization of this, and then I chimed in, and then we had to go to a break. Just to finish that up before we go over to some letters, don't you think there's a difference between maybe not even normalization, but a lot of people are just numb to it?
Well, let's put it this way.
If you keep on crying fire in the movie house. Does it have the same effect?
So is acquiescence the same as normalization?
Right.
So
right.
In other words, I used to tell my students, the day that somebody wins in the Electoral College and doesn't win the popular vote, people will be out on the street with their pots and pans. Well, they haven't, and we now know they won't. And in fact, I don't think I have seen an example yet of insult. We had the Mother's March. It was terrific. I was there and the rest of it. But I don't see, if David says normalization, that we sort of come to expect this guy to do this every day, but I don't see the popular reaction to it to be such that if we were in Argentina and other places, people would be out with their pots and pans.
Well, I guess my frustration stems from the fact that if the attack is particularized, right? So if it's an attack against women, you'll see the women marching, and boy, will they march, because you had such an amazing turnout when they in fact did. So if it's an attack,
immigration,
you'll have people actively involved. But when it's an attack on the free press, on democratic institutions, there's silence. Mm-hmm. And that's a danger to us
all.
Well,
there's silence and there's silence. I mean, you're right that the populi doesn't do what they probably ought to be doing in our minds.
But I think that dynamic has shifted. I think it's changed. I think we're kind of talking during the break too about how just individualized these issues are. I mean, we live in an era where you can pick and choose your social media platform and who's in that friendship circle. You can pick and choose which cause to donate to. You can pick and choose which candidate, you know, best represents you based on the issues. And I think a lot of the shifts we have seen in the midterms are based on people who are talking about specific issues that appeal to specific audiences and maybe re-engage people. It's the same thing why I think you have people shifting towards a more progressive Democratic candidate in Florida, and why you will probably have a woman, you definitely will have a woman entering Congress from Arizona this year. It's because I think there are these like microcosms, but because there are these microcosms, I don't think it's creating such unity, because I think, you know, there's not enough mobilization.
Well, the real question is, what's the level of insult that will make people take action?
I don't think that there,
well,
is a level.
And those probably on the right and left are looking also at what is it going to take to have our representatives react.
That I think is a much more important, you know, question, because I thought the day that he said, you know, that I was from an asshole country, I thought that, okay.
Well, all bets are off now.
It's official. Yeah. It's official.
We've crossed
ding,
the...
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like the next day, okay.
Well, and then you look at the North Korea summit, you look at what happened in Russia. You know, I mean, how many times, and we joke about it, but it's not a joke, but because how many times, we said it last week, but we've said it for maybe 27 weeks prior to that, this is the worst week this president has ever had. So to your point, it just keeps on sort of escalating, and we're never moving away from just like, oh, all right. Well,
yeah, so
and
you're right,
and
about this,
in such contrast, if you look at the contrast this week, right, with the death of a person that I didn't agree with on everything, but I respected John McCain. I respected his opinion. I always the only time that I was ever offended by John McCain was when John McCain was not living up to being John McCain. Because I thought that during the Obama presidency, he took shots that were just so beneath him. But you see this party that used to be his party becoming the party that now we just overlook everything that this particular president does. The fact that you had members of the Senate that were not screaming from the top of their lungs when that flag, you know, was not lowered, and one of their own, you know, had passed, and he was not shown the respect that he was due. The fact that you had his buddy Lindsey Graham, you know, not screaming and not being outraged, and the rest of his colleagues, and saying things like, or creating the false equivalence, well, they had their issues. That to me is just unforgivable. And it's like Mr. the Arizona senator
Flake,
who said that the damage to the party, he believes, is irreparable in long term.
Well, you know, I'm looking at the Ocasio-Cortez win. That was pretty interesting. Way behind, came 50 points. Think about that. The pollsters had her down 35 points, and she won by 15. So that's a total change of 50. And now in Florida, you have a gubernatorial candidate who is of color and who is outspent. No. A lot of times it was outspent in terms of money, and yet an audience came out to participate. A group came out to participate, and we found that. I find that to be the real story of what's going on in America today. Because if the pollsters had it wrong in Florida, and if the pollsters had it wrong in Ocasio-Cortez's district, what else don't they have when they see this newly energized, emerging group coming out who finally think that there's something to vote for?
Well, there's an invisible group out there. I mean, it's the same invisible group that had the impact in Alabama, and it's that same invisible group that had this impact now. But where it's going to be interesting is in the Senate race in Florida, because you have an energized group of people that are going to be out there working for both of these gubernatorial candidates. And so the bigger question is, how will that impact on the Senate race? That's
I think in that case too, because right now Gillum is sort of being pushed as sort of that Obama strategy where they're hoping to motivate more young voters. I'm sure the Parkland supporters and the minority group, but you can't just run on that alone. I think it'll be interesting who he ends up picking as his running mate. You know, will he ask Gwen Graham, who also did well and pulled in a lot of voters? That would be really interesting.
Now, what do you mean running mate?
In terms of just to sort of back
the lieutenant governor candidate. Yes. Yeah. I'm looking at the New York expats who are going down there. Now, I knew them. I grew up on the west side of Manhattan. They had very liberal instincts. And yet they went down there, and when Giuliani put himself up as sort of a right-wing candidate, as I mentioned before, they didn't vote for him.
I wonder, though, if Floridians would that win them over at this point. I really think it's about Florida issues right now.
Well, you know what? The other issue here that we're not talking about that I think deserves some attention is
weigh in on us.
if you're the RNC, right, and you have your money that you have to shell out to races all across the country, you see what's happening right now in Arizona, where you have probably the closest chance for a Democrat ever in its history in electing a senator and as well as a gubernatorial candidate in Arizona. Correct. And you see what's happening in Florida. You know, where do you throw your resources at? Where do you throw your money behind, given the fact that you have so many House seats that are also up?
But do you think there's any limit on how much money these people have to put into these campaigns?
Well, there are places where races shouldn't be so close, places that Trump ran away with.
Well, right, that will motivate a Koch or somebody else to put money in when they might not do it otherwise.
Even though Koch is being alienated by this administration.
Well, there's a difference between the congressional seats, we've known that for a long time, and Trump. So they'll put the money into the congressional elections, I'm sure. But in the case of the Florida governorship, it didn't seem to matter. You know, my mind goes back to when Al Sharpton ran for Senate in New York State long time ago, and he got 90% of the black vote. This is a black vote which ordinarily didn't come out and vote in an election. So they were telling you two things. They were telling you, you give us a candidate and we're going to vote for him. Mm-hmm. And they were also telling us, the rest of you are full of baloney. You know, we don't really think you'll ever do anything for us. So when you finally get a candidate who might do something, they know it. They just put their finger up in the air. They see the way that the wind is blowing. They say, finally we can have somebody that we can appreciate.
I agree with you. I just see so many, we haven't even talked about Ted Cruz and his race,
no.
Which these are places where the Republicans should be running away by wide margins. And these are races that are going to come right down to the last vote. Where does the RNC spread its resources?
And it's also interesting, too, that we have to go to a break, but we're also reminded of things like, you know, in our recent memory, Ann Richards, a Democrat, was the governor of Texas. The Democrats won West Virginia a decade ago. It's we have seen seismic changes as well.
I think when Democrats are true to their base and true to their values, I think you're always going to connect with people. It doesn't matter if you're working in a mine, if you're working in a mill, if you're working on a farm. You know, when someone speaks to your values, you're going to come out and vote for that person regardless of party.
All right, we got a ton of letters. All right, 12, but still, it's a lot. It's a good stack. It's a hefty.
They're stacking up.
It's a hefty stack.
It's heavy.
So we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll address those and much, much more when we return after this.
We'll be right back.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, and David Soares making up the panel this morning. We love your letters, and we've got a lot of them, so we'll get right to those now.
Right, Joe. Nancy says, elections. The voters who needed to be united are Clintonites, who still harbor animosity towards Bernie for carpetbagging the 2016 Democratic primary, losing and never really endorsing the ultimate candidate, helping elect what we are now living with. So, Alan, I would resist saying things like the Clintonites are dead. Did anybody hear me say the Clintonites are dead?
I didn't hear you say anything.
Okay. I'll stay out of it. But
you think I did?
Well, you didn't say that in that manner.
Yes.
You didn't mean it in that way.
McSally, who won in Arizona, is a Clintonite.
Hillary, we were talking about the Florida race.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. McSally, who won in Arizona, is a Clintonite. Hillary supporters need to be respected and kept in the fold. That certainly is true. I wouldn't argue with that. And Bill says from Amherst. I love Amherst. Did I ever tell you that? I wish to call to ask David's framing of last night's primary results as setting up a contest between extremes on both sides. What's extreme about issues like affordable health care, for example? His comment echoes Trump's good people on both sides. Please discuss this further. Love your daily discussions, Bill. I noticed that many of our writers, who we love, of course, have a great technique. First, they give you hell, and then they say, love your program.
or the reverse. Yeah. Love your program, and then, oh, by the way, you're a jerk. Yeah.
I don't think I was attacking the issues that these people stood for. It was just the fact that they both represent the what I would call the activist sector of our parties right now.
And Thomas says, Time Warner, a quick point. The Time Warner merger was mostly opposed for antitrust reasons.
That is true.
All right. Pardon me. And now from John, Florida. We spend our winters in Florida, Sarasota area, and are constantly confronted with how, in contrast to our home state of New York, which much of the state sits on the extremes, whether in wealth and poverty, religiosity and secularism, racism, intolerance, or politically right and left. Describing it as a cauldron is a most apt description. That its major parties have nominated an ardent Trumpist and Sanders progressive is emblematic of those deep divides. We hope for the scales to tip in the latter direction, as they often seem to portend, but the avaricious wealthy, the racist, and the right greatly benefit by voter suppression and dark money, and that's John.
Avaricious wealth? Oh, wow.
That's a carpetbagger with an English degree.
Mike says, who is supporting Trump? Hi, panel. I remember looking at Trump voters after the 2016 election, and somewhere around 12% of Muslim Americans supported Trump. I think that sexism and nationalism are the unspoken drivers of who supports Trump, and that scares me. And says Mike, stay cool.
Thanks, Mike.
There you go. And Jim says, violence. If things turn violent, say at the political convention, think about the prospect of Trump calling out the National Guard to police these protests. This is not just likely, pardon me again, but will also be supported without consequence for the well-armed far right. And will the military gun down their own citizens because Trump tells them to? And that's Jim from Glenmont. Well, I was at that Miami convention. What was that, 72? And the second Nixon nomination. And I remember that tear gas. It was quite something.
Yeah. Well, Chicago, Miami.
Sure.
People are passionate about issues, and sometimes violence erupts. But I've never actually heard the President of the United States of America actually call for it or promote it.
Or predict it in such a way that he's both calling for it and promoting it. Yeah. Okay. And Megan says, panel. Good morning. Something I've been thinking about and a conclusion I've come to, not all Trump supporters are racist, but all racists are probably Trump supporters. Agree? I added the word probably to be fair, and that's Megan in Voorheesville. Interesting letter.
That's interesting. Look, there's so much temptation to jump on that and to, you know, from the amen corner, but, you know, The reality is that people voted for that man because they saw something in him. And people who voted for him compromised on many of their values.
We started the discussion today, David, with the evangelicals.
Exactly.
I mean, think about it. Again, I want to project, if Obama had done anything which would be volitive of the way we consider to be, you know, towards one, women or wife or whatever, or cheating, you can be sure of what the reaction was going to be from these same evangelicals who are now saying we're all sinners.
I guess we're all sinners when we're getting what we want when we're packing the Supreme Court of the United States. I guess we can all be sinners. But just to get back to the point of the letter there, one of the things that I think we have to just get away from is labeling people based upon their political views, especially, you know, in this climate where not every Trump supporter that I've come across, are racist. But I am looking forward to when we can put America first and be Americans and be citizens again, and be kind to one another, because this volatility, this resentment over this particular president, it's just breaking us apart and allowing for him to do the things that he does.
And I wonder, what will change. I think some people who voted for Trump in the last election, maybe just weren't Hillary fans, or other reasons. And I think some of them, once they've seen him in his administration, are changing their minds.
It's all turnout. It's all turnout. It isn't that they're going to change their vote from, Trump to the Democratic candidate. It's, will you get off your behind and come out and vote and participate? That's what's going to control this election. Anyway, Teresa says, Hispanic support. As someone with a Mexican Trump-loving in-law, his thinking is that he's legal. It is also a class thing where legal immigrants do not want to be identified with their poorer brethren. I don't think that's true, but it's worthy of a discussion, don't you think? In other words, there seemed to be a tremendous Hispanic backlash towards Trump.
I think that's true.
I was going to say, you have to understand the cultural nuances of, Hispanic culture.
Yeah, I think she's right on the point. I've heard people, I've heard African Americans say things and favorable things about Trump that, quite oddly enough, I find shocking. But within cultures, there are certain dynamics that result in, a person of a different stature, socioeconomic group within that culture that has different values. Oh, I believe that.
Okay, so let's see. RB writes, love the bumper music. I hope everyone got up and did the Will and Carlton dance from the Fresh Prince of
Bel-Air. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. That's, you were doing that.
I'm just saying.
Okay. It's the Incredible Bongo Band is what we're listening to this morning. And you can find out a track list by going to wamc.org/roundtable. We post that every day.
And there's no one died, right?
No, it's not a tribute.
Okay. David hit the nail on the head on minority groups. You see this within the Indian community. Some Hindu Indian Americans hear Trump disparage Muslims, and it makes them support Trump because of the long-standing tensions between the groups in India. Mm-hmm. They cannot look past the fact that Trump would turn on them in a second and has no respect for any, in capital letters, person of color, including Hindu Indians. Minority groups need to get over the internal squabbles and start showing solidarity against attacks on any person of color. Mm-hmm. And Nancy says, good morning, panel. As a member of the public and someone who talks to members of the public, and we are not numb to the daily outrages made by the Trump administration and Republicans. We are waiting patiently for the Mueller investigation to do its work. This is our anchor in this storm. Well, let me ask a question on the pots and pans issue.
Yes.
If he fires Mueller, will you go out with a pot and pan? Will people go out with a pot and pan and yell in the streets?
This country.
I don't think so.
Don't think so either. Yeah.
I got to tell you, it is my hope. I have faith in the people that would be the step too far.
The guy to keep your eye on here is our Senate Majority Leader, who said you cannot fire Sessions. Sessions should stay where he is, despite the fact that some of the Republican senators are peeling off, you know, on this one. So it's fascinating.
And I don't, we just have about a minute, but does the group here assembled, because maybe this is just me, but I don't think so. It's not so much a matter if, it's just a matter of when, right?
If when what?
Sessions.
Oh,
the
I think
the fact that you have Lindsey Graham, you know,
right.
out mm-hmm. there,
okaying,
kind of, yeah, that's the trial
friend.
Balloon. That's mm-hmm. the trial balloon.
Right.
I think it's going to happen. I don't think anybody wants anything to happen, you know, until the midterms.
You can't mm-hmm. get. You cannot get to Mueller unless you get to Sessions. Mm-hmm. You can't get to Mueller unless you get to Rosenstein, and that's what this is.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll have many more letters and many more topics. Right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here. Jen Smith is as well. And David Soares is all part of the panel this morning. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We have many to get to, so we're going to do that. And then we'll move on to other stuff. Let's just say we have a lot of topics. We've touched on a lot of them already. So this is kind of a melange of different things that we have
I
today.
I like it when you say melange.
Melange.
Okay, so Kevin says Republicans have officially sold out. Since 80% of Republicans support Trump, they have sold. I thought the last time I looked, it was 90.
It was 90.
They have sold America down the river in favor of almighty dollar. I have always thought they were all about the almighty dollar, and this confirms that the stock market and the Second Amendment are Republican only true. The Republicans' only true vision, and that's it's signed Kevin from Melrose is angry. All right, and then we've heard from Deborah. Oh, and I like Deborah. She's a public official. Just let me say response. I believe resistance activity is focused on elections, not organizing a general strike, which we need to do at some point, but it is elections that can hold this disgraceful prez to account.
Resistance, then insistence.
And Brenda says, normalization. Consider the words helpless and hopeless. As a citizen, I'm at a loss to act without parameters of law and order, lawful activism, and have my country's institutions fail me. Gerrymandering, money in elections, electoral college misfiring. As a people, we are in shock. That's from Brenda. And Alan, we said that already. Alan is right. We did that one.
You keep repeating.
Right again.
Yeah, you keep repeating all the Alan is right letters.
Okay, so then Gary says, violence. Is there... If there is violence or some kind of civil war, we're screwed. They all have guns, and we have NPR coffee mugs. Thanks, Gary from Western Massachusetts.
Well, that's a great letter.
Well, yes, it is, but I must say I take some exception
the
to
crowd.
It. Because I take some exception to it. I think an NPR, it's true, an NPR coffee mug will not help you, but a WAMC coffee mug. Now, that's different.
Bulletproof.
So Eric says, independence. With both major political parties leaning toward their extreme edges, independents in America have nowhere to turn. Since many people are wary of change, people will not vote for the extreme left, but will plug their noses and lean toward the more conservative party, even if the current conservatives, in quotes, are nothing like the conservatives of the past. If Democrats want to win in November, they have to move to the center and pull in the independents. Otherwise, the people who don't vote in November will decide the election. You know what, Eric? I'm going to take some exception to that letter. And here's why. In retrospect, I voted for Bernie, of course, in the primary, and I announced it and all the rest. But in retrospect, I think Bernie would have beaten Trump. I do. Because I think the American people at that point, unbeknown to the Democrats, were looking for something that was not the same old, same old. Now, let's remember, of course, that Hillary got more votes than Bernie did. Excuse me, more votes than, yeah, than, and then Trump, certainly, that Trump did. It is interesting, Joe and panel, that the Democrats have just changed their rules again so that the big shots don't get automatic votes in the Democratic convention. They have said nothing doing. So that's going to be interesting to watch. Are you all following me on that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And the other thing is that I'm not so sure if people have a real choice that you won't get this phenomenal turnout among the people who consider themselves to be disenfranchised. And that is why I think Gillum won in Florida. I do. And I think it's why, and it's why I think Barack Obama won the presidency. We'll see, right?
You know, as voters, I think we're battered and bruised. Some of us are very cynical, but we love and we appeal to the message of hope. We appeal to the message of a bright future. And I think the successful candidate, the candidate that's going to get people, you know, to motivated to come out and vote, or people that are the candidates that can speak, you know, to the hearts of citizens, and I still believe that that's possible.
And one candidate isn't going to make the change, but I think by people continuously coming out to vote, to raise new candidates, you can be disenfranchised, but you still have to do your due diligence, and you still have to get out there. And I think that should be the motivation, if anything, just to get out and keep pushing the change, or else you're just going to continue the habit of, you know, acceptance.
Our responsibility. And the mm-hmm. fact of the matter is that the blueprint for change is in the Constitution. And this is the only country where, you know, we can change our direction. We can change our future by being involved in the process. And every time a person decides to stay home on a Tuesday where you should be out there voting, you're letting the other side win.
Sure. Aaron says, pots and pans. The reason people aren't out in the street is because you need to give them something to vote for. Who's going to go out in the street when Clinton lost the election due to the Electoral College? Clinton, who said single-payer health care was never going to happen, which every other industrial country has, and we, the richest country in the world, can't. And now Medicare for All is something that 70% of Fox viewers want. Again, it's the people in power's fault. And, of course, the decimation of the Communist and Socialist parties, which were part of the creation of the New Deal, is why people aren't out in the streets. That's from Aaron. And then Jane in Ankrum says—
I'm just to interrupt that, but I don't— But you still have something. Then if you don't have candidates that represent you, then you still have something to go out in the street with your pots and pans for, right?
Or, yes, that's true. Or that you like, Joe. I mean, when you had John F. Kennedy winning in Wisconsin, it was a charismatic leader. I mean, I remember it as if it were yesterday. And to this day, people have John F. Kennedy's pictures up in their houses next to Jesus, to be honest with you.
I'm just letting you know that in my county today, if there is one person who calls the police because they're being menaced by someone carrying a pot and a pan...
who are you going to blame,
I'm
David?
I'm coming for you.
I'd rather see more people at the polling stations than out in the street with pots and pans.
All right.
And Jane in Ankrum says, as a born, raised, and practicing Christian... Protestant, I find it unbelievable that the evangelicals are teaching the Ten Commandments to their children on Sunday and yet continue to support a man in every way who has unapologetically broken most of them. What do they tell those same children? Thank you, Jane.
Remember separation of church and state?
Mm. And Matt says, POTUS. I find I will never monetarily support WAMC again. The partisanship and the Trump hate is blinding you to the fact that he's actually doing a very good job standing against worldwide communism. And that's from Matt. Thank you, Matt.
Matt, continue to breathe from the bubble that you live in, my friend.
And Martin says, Gillum victory. Although Gillum won by a narrow margin, he was heavily outspent by the establishment Democrats. This gives hope that a network of concerned citizens, which is what a grassroots movement is, can turn the tide against post-Citizens United democracy. And that's from Mark. And Steve says, any mention of Dems being extreme is dubious at best. Any mention of Dems being extreme, parenthesis left, is dubious at best. Much of this talk is way off, and I, for one, don't appreciate it. Steve writes us a good deal of the time and just took a look at the numbers. Bruce says, loved Gwen Graham's statement after losing. After her loss, Gwen Graham said she telephoned Gillum. I said, now, Andrew, go out and win this damn thing. She said, because this is too important. I give you my word that anything Andrew asks of me, I will do. This is how you show support after losing immediate. Nothing held back, no sour foot dragging, and that's from Brucey.
All right. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some other stories. And we touched on a couple of these, but let me go back to the Google story because I do think it's interesting. Trump's economic advisors were taking a look at whether Google searches should be regulated. The Trump administration on Tuesday said it would explore regulating Google, an effort that would challenge protections around free speech online. In response to the president's allegations that the tech giant manipulates its search results to prominently display negative stories about him and other Republicans. President Trump, in a pre-dawn tweet, claimed that search returns for Trump News were rigged, all capital letters, by the way, rigged, for me and others, so that almost all stories and news is bad, all capital letters. Apparently responding to a report from
Fox News,
correct. Then his top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, said the White House is taking a look, quotes, at whether and how Google should be regulated by the government. Whether and how.
Should not.
Do you think it will be?
And the fact that those words were uttered, and those words are not sending shockwaves throughout, you know, anyone who loves democracy and freedom is so troublesome.
So with that in mind, let me read the next paragraph of this Washington Post article, which says, in the United States, it's just a helpful reminder, in the United States, regulating search results could violate the First Amendment, said lawmakers from both parties, free speech advocates and tech experts. The Trump administration's threat drew rebukes from Democrats and a few Republicans who said government shouldn't play a role in monitoring search results or other content online. The World Wide Web, except for that.
Yeah. And, you know, as I was looking for news this morning, when I Googled something that didn't even have Trump in the title, one of the first things that pops up in a Google engine is an info box on his Twitter feed. So the fact that that's on the front page of Google makes me say, like, you know, if it wasn't there, then, you know, maybe there's some question, but it's there. And I think every story out there, I've had Breitbart stories pop up in the top of my news feed. So, you know, it's just absolute nonsense.
Well, I'm trying to figure out who Googles Trump News. Who's seeking that out? Because that's pretty easy to find without putting it in your search engine.
The person he sends out to go find him, all the wonderful news that's out there about him, and they come back and they say, "Sire, I have not been able to find the news you are looking for."
Sometimes I think people just want to find out, like, what's the latest and, you know, what's he doing? And you might, it's just, you know, the way you type things.
The man creates his own. He creates his own chaos and his negative news.
So, and let's remember that it's all diversion, that he does it in order to get out from under the stuff that he...
Right. I think there are bigger issues that this government needs to be tackling than, you know, what shows up where in a search engine.
But he knows that outrageousness wins. Well, and that's what he is.
A lot of Molson drinkers are going to be upset if on Saturday... Their beer they go out and buy is twice the amount of money that it should be, right?
Jeez. Now, so I just Googled Trump News. The top three stories were one from the Huffington Post. Trump was forced to unblock Twitter critics. Now they're getting sweet revenge. That was one. The second one, Trump claims without evidence that China hacked Clinton email server. That is from NPR. And President Trump claims without evidence that China, not Russia, hacked Hillary Clinton. That is from USA Today. But the question about Google searches is it depends on who Googles, right? I mean, that's for
well, it's
me.
Based on your, yeah,
on your
personal algorithm.
Right.
So
oh,
I
is
think,
that right?
Yeah.
I think that's almost an invasion of citizen privacy then if you're looking to regulate that algorithm, which, you know, is very unique to Google and its alphabet company.
I find it very interesting that a man who condemns industries, who condemns people without proof, without any evidence, expects that while he's being investigated, expects that the standard of proof should be, you know, proof beyond all doubt.
Yeah. I think there are just bigger issues. I mean, one issue that stands out as we have these last couple minutes I'd like to talk about is the Roy Oliver conviction and the killing of Jordan Blake, and that just being sort of landmark in terms of convictions of cops and a white cop in a black teen case.
In Texas.
In Texas.
So white Texas police officer found guilty of murder for fatally shooting a black teen in a car. A former police officer was found guilty of murder on Tuesday for shooting into a car carrying black teenagers, killing one 15-year-old boy. Roy Oliver, who was white, was found guilty in the death of high school freshman Jordan Edwards, who was black. The teen was in the passenger seat of the car leaving a house party when the officer opened fire in April of 2017. Oliver was found not guilty on two aggravated assault charges. And it seems a strange moment when we're talking about the peculiarity of a white police officer being convicted of charges in a case involving a black youth.
Yeah, facts in this case were egregious, and I think it's important to mention that it's a disservice if all of these cases are lumped together. But you know, here is an instance where a prosecutor's office put on evidence and a jury sat and listened to the evidence that was presented and came back with a verdict that unfortunately is not one that is often returned.
And I think it was just a case where the facts really did prevail, and that there was time and care that really went into it. And I think when you heard Jordan Edwards' stepmom talk afterwards, you know, that was what was most important to her. You know, there wasn't as strong of protests as we've seen in other cases around the country, but it was just that the parties involved really did their due diligence.
Search for the truth. And there was effort put into that search for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at this case, I mean, you said it was egregious, but we've certainly seen other egregious cases that have gone the other way.
Yeah, I will tell you that watching the Trayvon Martin case as it unfolded live on television and watching the taking of testimony from the young lady who was a witness, you could sit there and tell that she had not been prepped. You know, her affect, there was no usually a prosecutor develops a rhythm with a person that they're going to be examining, and they're going to address those issues that they determine to be, problematic. But in this instance, you could just tell that boy, they didn't work with this witness. And I think that has a lot to do with the outcomes of these cases too.
Mm-hmm. I think absolutely. And I think, again, as we talk about issues that are on platforms again for the midterms and into the next several years, you know, race is playing a big part. And when you look at who's going to be in charge, I think we have, I don't know, I can't venture to say ever, but in my lifetime, it feels like I am seeing more candidates of color, people of color, who can make some of these decisions. And I think these issues that are happening in these localities will really matter when it comes to, you know, appealing to voters in upcoming elections.
Yeah, but it's also a reminder that in the midst of the racism that we see, the sexism that we're seeing, it's also a reminder that not everybody out there shares those horrible values, because in order for those candidates to be elected, it requires a lot of people that don't look like them to be out there believing in their message.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I felt like, yes, in a lot of ways it is a black and white case, but I think, again, just the fact that it it wasn't sensationalized as much. There's, I don't know, but it just feels like there was something very unique to this case and how it was played out.
Well, I know we have to go, but I can't wait for the Media Project this week when we should be discussing the fact that the Daily News and the New York Times endorses Zephyr Teachout for the Attorney General's spot. And all of a sudden, in their debate, she becomes the front runner because of these two major endorsements. It's incredible.
Are you going to talk about the Carl Bernstein story as well?
Go ahead. Yeah, we'll talk about the Carl Bernstein
story. Yeah,
that's
a good story. Too.
He had to take it back. Well, he's being implored to take it back.
That's right. Okay, all kinds of good stuff coming up on Media Project, and we'll be back tomorrow as well. David Soares, Jen Smith, Alan Chartok, thank you all. We'll be back after this short break.